This is class 4 of the Thousand Oaks Ecclesial Study Day, entitled Zechariah's Night Visions, God Provides the Motivation to Finish. And our speaker in his final class for today is our brother Jim Stiles.
Well, we made it to class 4. See, those of you that stayed, we have to stay now until we finish. Good job. Actually, I got to start out, first of all, thanking all the young children that are here. All of you young children that have been coloring and listening and doing all those things, note-taking. You've done a really good job today. You're a good audience, too. Good job. Keep it up. I imagine if Zechariah was here today, he would tell you that because of all the things you're doing in your families and your Sunday schools and ecclesias, that you'll be part of those children in Zechariah 8 that will be playing in the streets of Jerusalem. It's something really to look forward to. A lot of fun. All right, we made it to Vision 5, the fifth vision. Well, we'll try to get through 5 and 6 and 7, and if we don't, there's always the PowerPoints. Sign up for them. All right, Zechariah 5. When you start looking at this vision, in Zechariah 5, I think really what happens is this flows right on the heels of Vision 4. And at the end of chapter 3, well, what we saw in chapter 3 was Joshua standing there. And you can see how that would have been really encouraging to Joshua himself. Zechariah could build him up and say, look, God has chosen you. And you, Joshua, you're the one that the angel is standing there and the adversaries are opposing you. And he's asking God to rebuke that adversary on your behalf. And he's promised that he will clothe you in new clothes and you're going to finally function as high priest. And that cornerstone that you've been watching all this time, waiting for the day and will go up, that my servant, the branch, Zerubbabel, the one who should have been the king, was there and his hands are going to put this thing up. Now, to follow that up, you see, Joshua might have been thinking, well, you know, maybe there's more I got to do, and we got to get this thing finished. And you can imagine how all this encouragement about getting the temple finished, that some of the people would have been thinking, all right, we've got to go home now. We got to get involved. We got to go and do it all. And they would have been thinking, well, it's a lot to do. But some people, when you get working in ecclesial life, we tend to think, well, I got to do it all. You know, it's all up to me. And really, we only have to play a part. We don't have to do it all. And every so often we got to stand back and watch how God is involved in a lot of this and we just do our part. And Zechariah 4 actually plays right into that. You'll see how that fits in with chapter 3. Well, there's what he saw. He saw a vision, a little different than what we're used to in the tabernacle. There's a lampstand there. When you can see how they drew this with the seven lamps on the top. Only what's different with this one is you got the pipes going into the two olive trees that are on the side right there, similar to those two olive trees in Revelation 11. And the lampstand that's there. So you can see how this whole vision right here is a springboard for Revelation 11. This vision here in Zechariah 4. But what did it mean back then to these people? And you'll see in chapter 4 that this had a huge historical context to it as to what was going on. And what's happening is that there are two branches on each tree. There's one on each tree. Two branches that were dripping oil through the pipe into the bowl. And then the bowl was supplying the oil to the lamps and the lamps were burning. And that's what he sees here in Zechariah. Now, question for you. What's missing? What's missing in this vision about this light stand, about this lampstand that's there? What's missing in relation to the tabernacle? If you think of like Joshua sitting there watching this, Joshua hears about this vision and he realizes he's going to have his clothes changed. He's looking for it. I'm going to operate as a priest. And he sees this vision. Zechariah says, I saw this next vision. These two olive trees, these two branches, and these pipes going into a bowl, and there's oil going up into the lampstand, feeding those lights. And Joshua's sitting there thinking, wait a minute, in the tabernacle, you know, we got the same thing. We got the lampstand, we got the lamps, we got the oil that's going to be in the temple. And he's starting to think, well, what's missing is, did you catch it? That's the point of this whole vision. Sue knows. The people. You see, there's no human effort to keep the oil going. That's the difference, isn't it? See, every other time you'd have the tabernacle, envision of the tabernacle, the house all set up and the lampstands, you'd have the priest coming in to supply the oil every day. And it all kept going on the basis of people had to constantly keep supplying the oil. And what he does in this vision is he leaves the people right out and he says, look, here's the picture as God sees it. Here it is. We've got this whole thing set up with the trees, the feeding into the olive, into the lampstand, the lights going out, and you are going to be a light, all right. This community is going to become a light to the world, but it's not going to be by your human efforts that this is going to be done. And that's all of Zechariah 4. The whole chapter is about that issue. Not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord, that's how this will be accomplished. And that's what this vision was supposed to teach these people. So you look at the components of the vision. You got the lampstand, which certainly back then would have represented to them as it does to us today. It's the community of believers, and the seven different lights would have been the completeness of that community as it is in Revelation, that they're the lights that are going out, and they are providing the light to the world of drawing these Gentiles in, as you see happens here in Ezra. You've got the seven lamps, could be the individual ecclesias or pockets of believers, as you see in Revelation chapter 1. And we've got the lights, the revealing of God's character and his purpose to the unbelievers and believers. That's our responsibility as individuals in this thing. And as we are individual lampstands. We go home to our families, our ecclesias, to our neighbors. And we testify to them of the light of God's truth and his character in our lives. And that's part of what's in this vision. But in order for this to happen at this time, when it seemed like impossible for it to occur right then, God says that you're going to have to believe that it's going to be as a result of his spirit working in your life. He's going to accomplish some things that you couldn't possibly do yourselves. So the two olive trees, what in the world are they? Well, when you look at the olive trees as to how they're used in Revelation 11, anybody remember what they're called in Revelation 11? They're God's two witnesses, you see? The two witnesses. And you can see how Revelation 11 would have built that off of here in Zechariah. Because you've got the two olive trees that are standing there that are supplying the oil. It's God's Spirit, the oil, that's operating through these two trees that are providing oil to the community that provide their light to the world. And the keys to that operation right then, at that time, were Joshua and Zerubbabel, the king and the priest of the community. If they couldn't do it, and they couldn't encourage those people to go forward with this project, the project was going to fall on its face. And so the high priest and the king-elect that were there, Joshua and Zerubbabel, had to be encouraged in Zechariah 3 and 4 right here. God has promised he will use you, and he will use you too. And he is going to use the king and priest of the community to get this work accomplished and motivate the whole community to provide the light stand to that world. And that seems to be, at least, as the way this was applied back in that time. Most of our Christadelphian writers that look for historical applications did that as well. A little bit of a disagreement sometimes on the two olive branches as to who they were in verse 12. As Zechariah is asking questions in this chapter, he specifically asks down the line right there in Zechariah chapter 4, and you'll notice that he says, like in verse 11, what are these two olive trees, the one at the right of the lampstand, the other one at the left? And you further find in verse 12, what are these two olive branches that drip into the receptacles of the two golden pipes from which the golden oil drains? And he says, well, don't you know what these are? And I said, no, I don't, my Lord. And he says, well, these are the two anointed ones who stand beside the Lord of the whole earth. As your margin says, the two sons of oil. Which, a lot of folks in our community have looked at and said, well, probably what that was these two prophets, Zechariah and Haggai, through whom God's Spirit was operating at that time and providing the Spirit, the enthusiasm, the stirring up of those people with the prophets of God helping them, that it really was in this community right now, it was on the shoulders of Joshua and Zerubbabel and Haggai and Zechariah to convince these people to get this building done. And those four made a huge impact on this community and got them all working and involved in ecclesial life, got the building going, and in 4 years it was finished, just like that, after all those discouraging years when things had been run down. So that's a suggestion, at least, as to how the olive trees might work. Now, what about the mountain? When you look back in verse 7, what you find is that when God, first of all, presents this vision in verse 6, it says, this is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. Who are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel you shall become a plain, and he shall bring forth the capstone. See, this is why Zerubbabel must be the man whose name is the branch. All the way through this chapter, he had been predicted back in chapter 3, but now the man whose name is the branch, before Zerubbabel, you're going to be a plain. He's going to wipe this mountain out, and he's going to bring up the capstone and put it up on the top of this temple, and this building is going to be built with shouts of grace. Grace to it! Because it was all by God's mercy and his grace that this was ever done. So you go back and you look at, well, who is the mountain? And who else would it be but these Samaritans? It could be like even the Persian Empire that at this point, these people that had stood there as the adversaries, it seemed like a mountain to them that they couldn't get through. They were standing in the way. There was the decree that was made where they made them by force and cease. That would have seemed to these people like a mountain that was unpassable. The Persian king had issued a decree and said, that's it, you got to stop. And the mission at this point was over. And these people had looked at that and thought that mountain was unpassable. They could not get by it. And Zechariah and Haggai come along and say, get back to work. God will take care of that mountain. And he gives them this vision. You can imagine Zechariah going around telling these people after he saw this vision. All these people that were discouraged and the ones who were wondering about the edict that was sitting there in front of them. And they're out there working and they're wondering, are they going to be shut down? Are these people going to make them stop? Are they going to have to quit again because of what the king had sent out as his edict? And Zechariah would go out the next morning and said, good news! I saw this vision. This mountain that's standing in front of us, we don't think we can get by. God has promised that before you, Zerubbabel, this mountain is going to be leveled right down, and you're going to bring forth the capstone with shouts of grace to it. That's what I saw happening. And those people saw, they heard all that, and Zechariah went out and told them about this. He was probably thrilled, and he motivated those people, and they got back to work. And this is what did it. This is what convinced those people they were on the right track and that God would bless their efforts. So that's probably the mountain when you look at it. I think it's pretty clear that mountain back then. Now, what about the capstone? The capstone. Now, that's the last stone that gets lifted into place when the temple's all finished. A lot of people suggest they actually looked at the capstone, picked it out as the building was going on, and then in the end, as you'd all be waiting for that last stone to go up there, that capstone that would go up on the top, and every stone in the building then would feel its force as it came down and held the entire building together. And you can see that, you know, although in a literal way that was the application back then, can you see how this prophecy can be like thrown so easily into the future? When you look at how this applies to the Lord Jesus Christ and the spiritual building that he's putting together, with whom every joint and all the parts of it all fit together in the body of the Lord Jesus Christ. And in the end, it's all on the basis of shouts of grace. Grace to it. Nobody's going to walk into God's kingdom thinking that, well, I did this and this and this and this and this, and therefore, you know, I earned my way into the kingdom. None of us can do that. It's all on the basis of his mercy and his grace. And if you're ever wondering how that all plays out, just go back here and watch it work, because this is what was happening. These are the Old Testament examples of what grace, of how the balance of works and faith work together. What part do we have to do? What part does God do? There was no way they could deserve the opportunity to do this. And there was no way they could level the mountain themselves. But there is a part that we have to play. But all God has asked us to do is what we're able to do and capable of doing. He's never asked us to do the exact same work that Jesus Christ did. The capstone is in a different camp. He's done the work that we can't do. Of going through life in perfectly obedient. But here's what we were supposed to do. And when the capstone goes up and the whole building fits into place, all the rest of us will realize it was on the basis of grace. By grace we have been saved through faith. And those people back then would have said the same thing when that building was finally done. When they watched that last stone go into place. And they thought back over the 20 years they'd worked. And they realized all the troubles they'd been through, the adversaries that had stood in their way, the edict of the king that had come down, and then the prophets stirring them back up. And they got all done with that ecclesial project. A lot of people would have just sat back and thought, wow, look at what God let us do. Look at what he let us do. Something we just didn't think was going to be possible to finish this. And he did it. He did it, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord. And so it went up, and that stone went up, and it's certainly that's the lesson for us. It was God's grace all over that last stone, because there was nothing those people could have done to ever deserve it or in any way look back and say that, well, we did it by our power. You know, look what we did. Look what we accomplished. So God's house. God's house will definitely be finished, brothers and sisters. And his house in our lives is going to be finished the same way. Not by might, not by power, but by God's spirit operating in our lives. And you look at how this is going to work, like in verse, as you're reading through this section here, look in verse 9, at verse 8, the word of the Lord came to me again saying, but look in verse 9, because some of those people would have thought, well, maybe this temple is going to be built, Maybe it's finally going to be finished someday, but you know, it's probably going to be a long time down the line. And so there's the encouragement in verse 9 that it's going to happen soon. Zerubbabel's hands, you see, in verse 9, they had laid the foundation of this temple 16 years earlier, and now Zerubbabel's hands are going to finish it. In 4 years, it will be done. And you will know, this angel says, you will know that Yahweh of hosts has sent me to you when you see this happen. And you'll see that phrase all over Zechariah, because this was his promise to these people. And you'll know, just like Moses had said it in our readings before Pharaoh, you're going to know that Yahweh of hosts has sent me when you see these things happen. And the angel felt the same way, trying to encourage these people. You're going to believe me when you finally see it happen. And then you'll know that Yahweh really sent me to tell you these things. That little phrase comes up probably 4 or 5 times here in Zechariah. So that was the encouragement there. It was going to happen really soon. It really would get done right then. And the seven eyes. See, the seven eyes that we saw in chapter 3. To me, this is part of what ties this whole vision together, is really like one section right here. You look what happens in verse 10. After just telling him that Zerubbabel's hands have laid the foundation, his hands will finish it. And then you will know that Yahweh sent me. He says, "For who has despised the day of small things?" Who out you out there? Who of you out there? Who of you have looked back at this and just thought, well, this isn't near as good as what we had before. This project isn't worth finishing. This project isn't what I just envisioned it was going to be like. It's not like what I expected at all, and it really hasn't run the way that we expected it. We had all this trouble along the way. Who has despised this day of small things? For these seven, well, who are they? These seven, you see, these seven rejoice to see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel. That's those eyes that were watching over the capstone. And when the capstone went up into place, they were just waiting. Those angels were sitting there, when are we going to get this done? When are we going to get this done? How long is it going to be, God, before you have mercy on Jerusalem? And they've got the capstone lined up over there ready to go. They've got to get the people back to working, and they can't wait for the day in which Zerubbabel's hands are going to put that last capstone into place. The shouts of grace are going to go out. Those were the seven eyes that were watching that stone and guaranteed it was going to be put up. They are the eyes of the Lord, which scan to and fro throughout the earth. There's your angels all over the place here in this whole vision. And you'll see them. I really believe that's one of the major themes through Zechariah, is the work of the angels who are so excited about ecclesial life today, much more excited than we are. I mean, they just put us to shame. Sometimes we get depressed, we get discouraged, we get frustrated by things that are happening. Our angels are so excited about the children that are here, about the people that are developing, about the converts that are coming in from the seminars, about that they see the building being put together and the last stones being gathered from this race, and they can't wait until that house they've been working on for 6,000 years is finally assembled in one day. And God's family is born in a day, and those stones come out of the graves. Imagine what it's like from their perspective of all the years they've worked on this project, waiting for it to come about. And we get discouraged? We get discouraged and depressed? Wow, you know, to have people that have for years, in all of our troubles, are working on this for us, excited for that day when it will happen. Boy, carry that home with you, brothers and sisters, and think about it. Talk about those angels that are working with you, the ones that go home with you, and from their perspective, what ecclesial life is like. And I'll tell you, it will just motivate you to do things you just never thought were possible, because they're out there and they're excited, and they can't wait until that day comes. But the warning to us, as the warning was back here at this point in time, is we better beware, because if we are despising the day of small things, how are we ever going to go into the kingdom? If we can't see those angels, if we can't see the work in ecclesial life from God's perspective today, and we can't work with these little ones, and we can't get involved in our ecclesias, and we just despise, and we just discourage, and we run down everything in ecclesial life, we better beware. Because those that have despised the day of small things, they couldn't appreciate that spiritual house when it went up, and they won't appreciate the kingdom either. So that's the warning that's at the end of Zechariah 4. I think it's a good warning for all of us to consider. It's the same warning that Haggai brought forward as well, the day of small things. Now, as far as the angels go, I was going to say through Haggai in there as well. When you look at Haggai's section right there, that verse in Haggai actually came out of chapter 2 and verse 3. And you can see how when Haggai brought it up, he would have started out with this same kind of exhorting the people like Zechariah had done. But when he spoke to them about the remnant of the people in verse 2, he said, "Who is left among you who saw this temple in its former glory? And how do you see it now? How do you see the ecclesial project now compared to the ones that we had 20 years ago, 30 years ago, what you can remember in the past? You know, in comparison with it, is it not nothing? As nothing in your eyes? Well, maybe it is. Maybe it isn't as good as something 10, 15, 20 years ago. But what we have to remember is that God only expects us to do the best we can with what we have right now. That's all he expects. And because he intends to tear it all down anyways. And he's going to build another one that will be even greater. That's what Haggai goes on to say. He goes on and says, the latter glory of this house will be even greater than the former one. Because I'm going to make one that's even better than that. If you believe. If you believe. And that's exactly what the kingdom will be like. The latter glory will be greater than it is right now. Well, you know, you can look around today and have a lot of reasons to get depressed. Ecclesias are small. Many ecclesias have simple buildings. We rent. We use homes. Sometimes our witnessing projects seem to be maybe a little bit simple and small compared to other things, or other projects that are going on. In our services, we tend to use everybody. Everybody. Every brother is available to use. If somebody wants to play the piano, they're willing to let them play. We don't have the best that are out there. That's not the way we operate, because we realize these are all stones that are going to fit into God's temple. And although we may use all these things, we could easily despise the day of small things in ecclesial life. And I think, brethren and sisters, that's a great warning we can take home today about our ecclesias and our families. It may not be the greatest and the best thing that you can envision. It may not be as good as it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, whatever. All God wants, though, is that we are working and doing the best we can with what we have right now. And that's his responsibility to make it even greater. And he will do that in the age to come. We just have to do and work with what we have right now. Now, what about the angels? When you look at the angels' involvement in Zechariah, at some point it'd be fun to just go back and look at all the angels in Zechariah. I just like to figure them all out, who they all were and how they were involved. But at least, you know, as far as some of the ones that are there, we know that the angel of the Lord was Michael. We know the angel who talked with me. All the way through this, there's always an angel who talks with me. And the angel who talked with me. It was like an angel that was right there with Zechariah, helping him understand what was happening, different than the angel of the Lord. Some suggest that may have been Gabriel, because a lot of times Gabriel would show up at major events and communicate to people what was actually happening, whereas Michael seems to be more the one who like gets out there and does it. And then we got all of those angels that stood before him. One of the things I find fascinating about these angels, when you study them, is that the angels are always working together. They're always cooperating together. They're always on the same page. They're helping each other out. Those angels that walked along the road with Abraham, and they looked at each other and said, "Well, should we go tell Abraham we're going to go destroy Sodom and Gomorrah?" They talked about it and said, "Well, we better tell him. You know, we haven't hidden anything from Abraham, and you know, we're going to make a great nation out of him. We better go back and tell him." So an angel goes back and tell him, and the other two all go on down to Sodom and Gomorrah. That's the way angels are. They're always working together in ecclesial life, in God's family. And, you know, brethren and sisters, if this is what we hope to do, if we hope to be equal to the angels, and we hope to play their role in the kingdom age of working in God's family with the mortals on this earth, if that's what we hope to do then, we've got to learn to work as teams now. This isn't just something that's automatically going to all of a sudden happen where we're made immortal and all of a sudden all of our inabilities to work with people are gone, just like that. Now is the time when we practice it. That's what our ecclesial life and our family life is for. Children with parents. And wives with husbands and husbands with wives. This is when we practice teamwork. This is our practicing ground so that we can do it forever. This is our opportunity to try it out and see how we do. And if we don't like it, how are we ever going to like the kingdom? How are we ever going to like the kingdom? Because what God offers us is to do it forever. Do it forever with a bunch of people that are great team players. It's the ultimate opportunity of a lifetime. It's so exciting to think about it. You look at the involvement of the angels in this book right here, in Zechariah 1, Zechariah 2, Zechariah 3, Zechariah 4, and you can keep on going into 5, into 6, and right on through this book. But especially at the beginning, the angels are extremely involved in this whole section right here, because they were carrying it all out, and it was definitely an exciting period to let these people know about the work of the angels. Now, I just want to jump ahead into the last class. Since I never figured out how to do this, I'll jump ahead the old way. All right. Plus, you get a momentary break, too. That was your seventh inning stretch. All right. That was Zechariah 4. Now, what about 5? So, now we got the promise that, yes, he's going to use Jeshua. We're going to finish this temple, and Jeshua, you're going to have your clothes changed, you're going to operate as high priest, and at that point, you're going to play your role, and I'll forgive the entire nation of their iniquities, and I'll bless them from this day forward. Zechariah 5, the promise was that through Zerubbabel, that the capstone would go up, and that the angels were watching on that, ready to roll. And now we find in Zechariah chapter 5, in this next vision, this next vision is like sort of like a vision that lets you know, here's God's plan. Here's what he's got in mind when all this goes on. Zechariah chapter 5, the sixth vision. So now he looks, some of our versions say, then I turned, although most of the other versions don't have that, and they don't really say that belongs in there. And he raises his eyes and he sees the flying scroll. Well, Matt was back there. Matt had a little. Did you want to show your little class model right here, Matt? Matt has a little class demo here for the flying roll. Yeah, here he goes. There you are, flying roll. That was a pretty good throw, Matt. We'll sign you up. The flying roll, yeah. All right, the flying roll. Well, it was written on both sides, right? The flying roll. The flying scroll. Actually, my version says it's flying scroll. But you can see, here's the vision, the flying scroll. And here's what we got. We got this scroll. It's a 20 by 10 in cubits. It curses thieves and perjurers, people that swear falsely and people that steal. And we've got an ephah and a basket with a woman inside. And this woman tries to get out, and this lead disc gets put on the top and jam her back in there. And then two women come along, and they fly this basket back up to Babylon. What in the world is that? You wonder, well, what did that mean to these people? But you see, now you can either look at this from the, and I do agree with the futuristic, the interpretation of the future from here, the latter-day application, when it definitely did apply to the woman of Babylon that would take her mystery religion, take it up to Babylon, and from there they'd set up the throne and up in Babylon from which all the mysteries of religion have come. It definitely has that application in the future. But what did it mean right then? What did it mean to these people? Well, now that this temple is going to get built, and it's going to be finished, and the capstone's going to go up into this temple, what God wants Zechariah to let the people know is, this is going to carry some consequences and responsibility to the people. One was to Joshua back in chapter 4. Now it's to the people that are out there in Israel. When God's temple goes up, and he builds his house, and he intends to have his glory there in their community, there is a responsibility at this point. You can't just continue to live in sin. There's a responsibility to clean up your act. And he uses those two examples of the thieves and the perjurers on the scroll as examples of like some of the worst kind of cases that you could do of stealing from God and swearing falsely from him. If you think you're going to get away with this and claim to be a Christadelphian, and you're going to just keep leading a life of which you're living a life of lying and stealing from God and swearing falsely and not really meaning what you think, I'm going to tell you that's not the way it's going to work. And he intends to clean up the land. That's what he wants to do. So he sees this vision about what it's going to be like when he cleans up the land of Israel. So the flying scroll, what in the world is this thing? It's got the same measurements as the holy place of the tabernacle, so it's definitely a link mentally that you would be thinking about the tabernacle and God's law being there in the tabernacle. It's written on both sides, just like the Ten Commandments. If you didn't realize that about the stones back in, although you picture those stones, we always see the writing on the front. It does say back in the Old Testament that they were written on the front and the back, on both sides of the stones. And it's flying right throughout the land. And the idea of flying, just like that roll, when it went flying, you see, that indicates that it's spreading out fast. And it's spreading out amongst this land. Once this temple is built, there is going to be a rule, or what he calls a curse, that's going to go out over the land. And this curse is going to hold all of the Jews responsible to where if God's house is going to be here and his glory is going to be in the center of your community, then you all are going to have to live like you want God in your midst. There's responsibility to this. And if you don't, for all the people that don't, he's going to kick them out of the land. And where are they going? You go back to Babylon. Back to Babylon. And that's what I think happens in this vision when you look at what it meant to these people. So that's the way he laid it out before him with the flying scroll. There's this curse. He calls it the curse. You'll notice in verse 4 that it is sent out by God, this curse. In verse 4, I will send out the curse, and it's going to enter the house of the thief and the house of the one who swears falsely, and it will remain in the midst of his house and consume it with its timbers and its stone. Now, where have you read that before? Where have you read about something consuming the house with its timber and its stones? See, that was like leprosy under the law, you see? And so that's what he says. If you're the kind of person that you're leading a lie, you're swearing falsely before God, you're stealing from God because you're taking his time, and you're in ecclesial life, but you really aren't a part of it, and you're just like putting on a facade and it's a fake, God says that's like a leper in the land. And your house, this curse is going to go into your house, and it's going to consume your house because you don't belong in his community. That's how he sees it. There is a responsibility to having God's house go up in your midst. This is not just playing games. This is serious. When God extends his kindness and his mercy to us, and he calls us into his family, and he gives us all these benefits that he gives to his children, he expects a return. He expects an appreciation. He expects that we're up front with him and we're leading a real serious life of trying to walk as a member of his family. And if not, out goes the curse to these people. So the purpose of the curse, when you look at what it was designed to do, it was designed to kick out the thieves and the perjurers, get rid of them, out of the community. They're going to be clear out of his land. He sees this chapter as one in which once his temple goes up, he's going to clear his land of wickedness. And the land is going to be brought back. That's why he kicked them out in the first place. If you go back in Jeremiah and look at what had happened, he said they'd ruined his land. It was his land, not theirs. They'd ruined his land. He said, I'm going to let my land enjoy its Sabbath and kick you all out. And now when he reestablishes his temple, if you're not serious about this, you don't belong in the land. So he's going to expel all the thieves and the perjurers, and he consumed their homes. They're going to suffer the same fate as those with leprosy. You can see that in Leviticus 14 or in Matthew chapter 10. So that's the purpose of the curse. And what this will then do is that he's going to purge the land of all of this wickedness around his house so that his house can exist amongst his family. And that's what he intends to do. Now, that would have been something serious for Zechariah to tell these people as his house is going up. This is not just something, we're not just building God's house so we can go on and play fun and games. This is something in which there is responsibility. Now, I know in our community there's a lot written about this word where it says cut off in the King James, or the New King James says expelled. And you look it up and you see that it really means to be made free. It means to be like set free is really what the root of the Hebrew word means right there. But if you check the word out, I looked it up in the theological workbook of the Old Testament, that big, thick book. You look it up by Strong's numbers. And what you find is that why did the translators go with this idea of cut off or expelled if the word means to set free? And the reason is that as you read through, I know some of that small print that's right there, but the bottom paragraph right down here is that not only can the sinners be set free, in the sense of, usually it's used about a person being forgiven or set free of their guilt. Usually it's related to the guilt that a person has. Not only can the sinners be set free or cleansed, freed of guilt, acquitted or held innocent, but a place can be purged of the evil found in it. The cutting off of the liars and the perjurers from the land spoken of in the vision of the flying roll in Zechariah 5 would amount to a purging of the land from evil. And I think if you follow down the context of Zechariah 5, you'll find that's exactly what's happening in this chapter. This chapter is all about purging the land from evil, getting those people who really don't want to be a part of this community out of the land. Although the call was come out of Babylon and come back to the land in chapter 2, now the warning is if you don't really want to live this way, God's going to have you kicked out. He doesn't want those people in his land. And it's going to be set up an entirely different system for all of you that are into the economics and you want all the benefits of this world and all that. He's going to set you up a whole place up in Babylon. There's our mystery Babylon in which that whole system will be set up there, and you can go on up there instead because you don't belong here in his land. He intends to clean his land. And that's the curse that goes out here at the beginning of this chapter. So God's house being built up brings responsibility to us, brothers and sisters, and it's true for us today. We can't just go on and live a lie. We can't do that. We've been given opportunities of a lifetime. And there are consequences and responsibilities that go with that. So what God wants us to do is he wants us to live and dwell. What he wants to do is live and dwell among his people. That's what he intends to do. And when he does that, he's going to have to clean up those people around them because he can't dwell among the unrighteous. You look in Numbers chapter 35, you find, "Therefore, don't defile the land which you inhabit, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, the Lord, dwell among the children of Israel." That was what he warned them of back in Numbers. Once he dwells amongst the community, you can't afford to defile his land. And if you do, he's going to have to remove you from the land, and you won't be a part of it. Whether it's by another entire removing of the people, which he did, like another captivity, or whether it's just removing some of those who needed to go out of the land. Well, that's the suggestion of what happens here about that little section there about the scroll. The lesson for us, I think, is that certainly we want to remember that adoption into God's family does bring responsibilities and membership to God's ecclesias. When we belong to ecclesias and God gives us the opportunity, the angels have provided ecclesias for us, we have a responsibility to work in those ecclesias. Try to work with the people, get along with one another, and practice teamwork now so that we can do it, hopefully, by the mercy of God in the kingdom age as well. You find that the Apostle Paul warns about the same kind of things in 2 Corinthians 6 when he tells everybody to come out from among them and be separate and don't touch what is unclean, and I will receive you. That was his warning, that if we want God to be in our life, we can't be living as though we are in this world. We've got to be living a different kind of life where we live like his children, and then we will be sons and daughters of the Almighty. Now, what about the woman in Ephah? Who in the world is this? Well, first of all, what in the world is an ephah? If you look up the word ephah, you'll find out it was the standard measurement that was used. It was like a bushel basket. And it was the standard measurement that they use in measuring grain and other articles in commerce. It would be like a standard unit of measurement that you have for any kind of trading that was going on. And because of that, it got linked and associated with economics. And it'd almost be like trading stocks today or something. You have stocks. It was like, it was something that, to everybody's mind, it would be representing some kind of economics and some kind of, going into materialism of that kind, about looking at money and the idea of the ephah, your measurement for, how far up you were in the classes and so on. This bit about the ephah. So the suggestion is that what happens with the woman in the ephah is that we've got this woman here who's sitting in the ephah, and then she's pushed back down and the lid's put on her. So the suggestion is that what she does is she represents a community of people, a religious community, but collectively she represents all of those Jews who didn't want to be a part of this real kingdom, this house of God that was going up. The people who despised it. The people who didn't want it because they wanted the freedom. They wanted the time to work on their own homes and to build up their own bank accounts and all these things. That she represented the evil side of the community at that time. She was the apostate woman already developing within the community again since they had come back from the land. And you'll notice that word that's used in verse 6, when it says in our Bibles right here that this is their resemblance throughout the earth. The "there" is a reflection back on the earlier vision at the beginning of the chapter, the perjurer and the thief. This was the false swearer and the thief. And this is their resemblance now. She's symbolizing these people that want to steal and swear falsely, and they're bringing all this into the community, and God's saying, "Look, I'm going to cut you off. I'm going to rip apart your homes like they were leprous homes, and I'm going to put you into a basket where you want to be, and your crazy economics, that's all you care about are the economics. Put a lid on the top of you, and I'm going to fly you right out of my land, and I'm going to clean up my land. This is going to be a land for people who really want to be a part of God's family." Now, you can see what a message that would have been back then. And what an application it is to the kingdom. I mean, this is the message the saints will carry out to the kingdom. This is the message going out to Israel. This is the message that we will carry throughout the world. God's kingdom's coming. His house is going to be built. There'll be another temple on this world. But if you don't want to be a part of it, if you don't have time for God, you don't belong in his kingdom. And that's a message that will go out in the days to come as well. And you can see the old application of it. You can see how it would apply in the future as well, of the woman in the ephah, as well as how it applied to the mystery Babylon system that's out there today. Who is the woman? We got that one there about who she represents. We're going to go on. The this is wickedness. That phrase that comes up about being this is wickedness, some of you may be aware that that's actually picked up by Paul in 2 Thessalonians 2. In the Septuagint version, That word for wickedness is one where he says lawlessness. He calls it lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians 2. And that's why we think we're on the right track when we figure that this vision had a future application to the apostate system that was going to be developing after the times of Christ, when the apostles were gone and the spirit gifts were withdrawn, as you see happening in Revelation. So the woman, what she does, she tries to escape, spreads her influence throughout the land of Israel, and that's what she wanted to do. And she wanted to get out of the basket and spread her influence all over the land. And God says, I'm not going to let that happen. The angels are going to protect my land, and they're going to push you back down in that basket, and they're going to fly you right out of the community. So the angel thrusts her back down, puts a lead cover on her, and you can see that's part of the work of the angels. Part of their job is to work in ecclesial life and to suppress some of the people that want to come up sometimes and give the ecclesia a direction that we really shouldn't be going, or people that have that kind of an influence. And it's their job to suppress that and carry this woman right out of there with the basket. And the two women may represent apostate Judah and Israel, as they developed in the end, that the two apostate system, which was pretty common back in Jeremiah and Ezekiel and so on, and God uses them to fly the basket right out of the land. He flies it up to Babylon and has something built in Babylon where the woman is put on her little pedestal up there, and a whole house is built for her. So while God's house is being built in the land, and they're going to finish God's house, he in effect says, all of you who don't want to be a part of this, you can go build your own house up there in Babylon, and I'm going to build there's going to be a whole system built up there for all of you that just want economic prosperity, and that's all the kind of stuff you care about. There'll be a system built up there for you, but it just won't be one of truth, and there'll be no hope of a kingdom for those people that are in that one. So that's the section there. Now, what about the last vision? Got a few minutes? We'll have a look at the seventh vision, and we'll leave it at there today. The last vision, Zechariah's seventh vision here, here's what he sees in chapter 6. He sees four chariots coming from between two mountains, and the mountains were bronze, and he's got the four chariots again. We got the red horses, the black horses, the white horses, and the dappled horses. And he says, well, what are these in verse 4? And the angel says, well, these are the four spirits of the heaven who go out from their station before the Lord of all the earth. So here's what he sees. You got the four chariots coming between the two mountains. We got the horses, the four spirits, or some people say the winds of the heavens, and they go to the north, the south, the east, and the west, probably, and they bring rest to the north. And you look at the time, what in the world that meant? Well, the chariots, just like back in chapter 1 with the horses, that those horses had brought rest. This time it's chariots going out because they are enforcing God's will in the planet. And what these visions, these night visions end up with, we started in chapter 1 with the angels coming back and the horses and saying, we brought rest. And we end up with the last vision of the angels going out and saying, look, we're going to make sure this continues. We're going to suppress this problem in the north that's coming up. And we're going to make sure that this will continue until this house is built. And God will guarantee that it's done. You've got the red and the violence and the bloodshed, the black and the mourning, the white, the victory and peace, same you see in Revelation. And then we got the speckled or the gray one, the mix of mourning and victory. These are the kind of tools that the angels have, and they go out to enforce God's will and bring this kingdom back under control. And the promise was that they would do it. And when you read the history, you can see pretty clearly that's what they did. Darius, in his first year, in his second year, he went out and he waged war against all these provinces that were rebelling against him at that time. The Scythians, the Macedonians, all the way over to Egypt, as far as in Babylon. And these angels brought the kingdom back under control. And they brought it under control so that finally, that Joshua could be coronated at the end of this whole chapter. And so you run into the end of the night visions in chapter 6, verse 9, when the word of the Lord came unto me saying, that actually is the end of the night visions. And where you end up at this period then, at the end of the chapter, is the coronation of Joshua, that after the night visions are over, and now God has made all these promises about what he is going to do and encouraged the people and assured them that this is what he's going to accomplish, the night visions now end up now with this little vision at the end of chapter 6, where Joshua now is going to be coronated, and it's one that would have applied then in a sense, but it definitely would be one that would apply in the future, the coronation of Joshua. Now, here's what happens. These three fellows are seen returning from Babylon, Hodiah and Tobijah and Jediah, and they bring a gift of silver and gold. Now, what this would seem to indicate is that not only did the captives come back in Ezra chapter 1, but some captives were coming back. They were like filtering back in the land periodically. And so these captives come back now three people come back, and there's maybe more than three, but at least these three, and they've got a gift of silver and gold. And what he sees is that, look, take this gift from these people, this silver and the gold, and you're going to make an elaborate crown, and we're going to put this crown on Joshua, the high priest, and what we're going to do is we're going to crown him now, the man whose name is the branch, and in one man, Joshua, we are now going to, in a vision, take one person, and we're going to represent this one man as the king and the priest of this community. And that's what happens at the end. You get Joshua's role at this point is that he's going to branch out. You see in verse 12 right here, behold the man whose name is the branch, for from his place he will branch out, which is really what this word means. He's going to build the temple of the Lord. Yes, he shall build the temple of the Lord. He's going to bear the glory or the honor. He's going to sit and rule on his throne. He's going to be a priest on his throne, and the council of peace is going to be between them. Now, you see, this has really never happened. But the prediction was that this is the attempt is what they were going to try to accomplish with Joshua because they didn't have a king. Zerubbabel could not reign as king right now because they didn't have the power. The Persians were in control. They didn't have any king in the land. So Joshua now is now presented at the end when God's house is finished. And he's crowned king and priest at one time. And you can see how encouraging that would have been to those people. But look at the future application to the Lord Jesus Christ when we realize that he's the one who really this was pointing forward to, that he would bear the glory, he would bear the honor, he's going to sit and rule on his throne, and he will be a priest on his throne. And finally, we will have a Messiah who will unite both offices of king and priest, the king who would rule in judgment and the priest who would extend mercy, and we'd finally have a righteous ruler who can balance out righteousness, they balance out mercy and justice. And that was the prediction that was going to come. And the best that you could do at this point would be to use Joshua as the one. So what they did is they put together this crown. They put it, they got it ready and set it on the head of Joshua. And then what they did is at verse 14, they took the crown, or in verse 15, they set it aside. And then they said, look, when the temple's finished, then we'll finally put it back on him again. And this then became something they could go to and look at, this crown, that they could then set it, they could actually go there and say, someday when we get this finished, there's the crown sitting over there like the capstone. This crown is going to sit on Joshua's head, and he's going to sit here and rule as high priest over our community, and as king in a sense, because we really don't have a king right now. And finally somebody will bring unity between these offices of priest and king for the first time. And you look at, well, why was Joshua the king priest? Well, they didn't have a king priest. They didn't have a king at this time. The role of the priest was going to become extremely powerful and valuable in the community. And Joshua was going to have that position. And it was a great way of predicting, brothers and sisters, and we look to the future, about Messiah who would come. And what a great way to end these night visions on a role in which you have finally represented that when God's house is put together, the basis of it all will be that Messiah is there and crowned and throned and sitting on his throne, ruling as a priest who can balance out justice and mercy, who can bring people to God as the priest did, and yet do it in a way of righteousness that he only brings the people that can be pronounced righteous before God and extends mercy to those people and fits them into his spiritual house when that temple is finally put together. And that's the way the visions end. And I hope you found that, this section today, at least in looking at Zechariah's visions, a little bit exciting. Maybe we can go home and apply some of these things in our families and our ecclesias. Keep the visions in mind. Look at what God promised these people. Remember how the angels were so involved in the lives of these people then, even though nobody could see them, just like they are today. They're working for us behind the scenes, and they want us to find success. They want us to make it. They're enthusiastic. They're excited, and they can't wait for the end of their 6,000-year job of finally establishing God's kingdom and fitting those stones into his spiritual house when his family will be born in a day.